Hello, welcome you all. That seems a little loud, but my name's Bill McKibben, and it's a great pleasure for me to be here. I've been looking forward to this for a long time until about 2 hours ago when my my wife called and said, where is this place you're at again? South by Southwest. You should read this thing online about how they like booed somebody off the stage yesterday and made them, because you better be really careful what you say. And then I got here, and of course, Bill, who's doing the sound, the first thing he asked me was, you know, what I wanted to plug in to show pictures with, and I had to confess that I had nothing to plug in at all, that I was merely going to talk, which is what I almost always do. And usually I don't really make much of it, but here I feel the need to pretend that really what I'm done is kind of invent a new technology, a kind of virtual PowerPoint that, you know, if used successfully, the pictures will just appear in your head, you know, without any expenditure of fossil fuel or anything to make it happen. But it does take a little mental energy on your part for this to work, so bear with me. I want to talk about three things today in order. And it's a great pleasure to have an audience that I'm going to make the assumption is scientifically and numerically literate and won't have any problem dealing with a little science, probably a little more compressed than I usually do it. I'm going to talk about the science of climate change and where we are right now and why it means that we have to move so quickly. I'm going to talk about how we haven't moved quickly yet and why politically, and then I'm going to spend a little more time talking about how we hope, with your help, to be able to move a little more quickly, in fact, a lot more quickly in the next few years. And as I start, I want to introduce my colleague, John Warno, who's sitting back there, John, just stand up for a minute, people can see who you are, who's here all week, and who I've worked with for years now and has really been the web guru, among other things, behind our work. And I'm happy to have him here. Look, I wrote the first book about global warming now 20 years ago, first book for a general audience. And I know that you all understand climate change, and I'm not going to bother going through any of the specifics of it, except to say that historically there have been sort of three periods in that 20 years, and each one of them comes attached to a number, and those numbers, especially the last one, are important. 20 years ago when we started, global warming was in the nature of a hypothesis. We thought it was a strong one, but you know, it's also emotionally counterintuitive. The idea that human beings had grown large enough to actually alter the most fundamental force on the planet seemed somehow unlikely. And so science went to work from the period roughly 1988, 1989 to 1995, went to work with real vigor on this problem, more vigor than expended on any scientific problem in any similar period of time. And by the end of that five-year period, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was able to declare that indeed human beings were heating the planet and that it was going to be a serious problem. It was a kind of coming-of-age moment for us as a species. There was a number attached to it, and that number was probably about 550 parts per million. That's the number that we were thinking of then. And the reason we were thinking of it was pretty simple. The pre-industrial revolution concentration of carbon in the atmosphere is 275 parts per million, okay, before we start burning coal, gas, and oil. The computer modeling that we had in that period was still relatively simple, at least compared to today, and our understanding of the feedback mechanisms and things of the planet to our added CO2 were pretty crude. And so the number that scientists were working with just to kind of try to model the system was to say, what would happen if we doubled the forcing, doubled the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, what's the result that we would get? And that's pretty much how all the discourse was conducted scientifically. And it had the odd but probably predictable effect of leaking over into the kind of political consideration of this question. So that the first set of kind of targets and plans and things that people began talking about were all, you know, in policy people, were all around that 500. How do we keep things from doubling? That seemed like the danger zone, okay? The next 10 years, 1995 to 2005, are kind of the period of not hypothesis, but of proof. It's as if the planet itself had decided to peer review the science. We had 10 extraordinarily warm years in a row. And with them, we began to see that we'd underestimated how quickly, at what a low level, the planet responded to excess carbon. Okay? So far, human beings have increased the temperature of the planet about 1 degree, which 20 years ago we would have thought would be just kind of the beginning entree into the global warming era, that the real big change would still be a few decades out. But it turns out we were quickly figuring out that the planet was more finely balanced than we'd imagined. And so, you know, name your parameter, things began to shift very quickly. We saw big changes in hydrological cycles, much more, since, you know, warm air holds more water vapor than cold, much more drought in arid areas, much more deluge and flood in wet ones. We saw the change in range of all kinds of creatures, including most notably and already very significantly the range of the mosquito, one of the animals that responds most positively to a warmer and wetter world. There are lots of places now in this world where you couldn't get malaria 20 years ago and you can now. The rates of dengue fever are growing 100, 200, 300% a year in some parts of the world now, largely attributable to change in climate. I was in Bangladesh a couple of years ago and managed to come down with dengue in the first big outbreak that they've had. And, you know, I didn't die, but a lot of people there did. And it was particularly striking to look around and realize that they had done literally nothing to cause this problem. When the UN tries to estimate how much carbon each country emits, Bangladesh is a rounding error. The 140 million people there don't burn enough fossil fuel to be a measurable quantity. And yet their, you know, very lives in many ways are under assault from the habits of the rich world. Even things like seasonality shifting markedly, with winters in the Northern Hemisphere becoming much, much shorter, an average of 3 weeks or so than they were even in the 1970s. The number associated with this period of proof is 450 parts per million. As people began to get a little worried that things were happening a little faster, that's kind of the number that some of the big environmental groups in the European Union and things hit on to sort of aim at as a new target. It's a pretty, would be a pretty tough target, and, you know, it was ambitious. But they were saying, huh, things are getting a little out of control. We need to start amping up this reaction. Okay. The period of the last 2 years or so is not the period of hypothesis or of proof, but the period of fear, because it's become remarkably clear in the last 18 to 24 months that, in fact, we'd seriously underestimated just how fast and just how big the reaction to this change was to our excess carbon in the atmosphere was going to be. And as a result, scientists have radically recalculated what the possibilities are, what makes sense. The signal event here, probably more than anything else, was the rapid melt of Arctic sea ice last fall, last summer and last fall. Arctic sea ice, you know, reaches its minimum each year in mid-September, late September, before the long Arctic night descends and things begin to refreeze. And it had been getting steadily smaller for 30 years. The old record was set in late September 2005. And at the time, that was about 22% or so below the old pre-1970 norm. So pretty significant shrinkage already, easily visible from outer space on a satellite photo, the world much less white, much more blue in the summer. This year, we blew by that record on about August 16th. And thereafter, we were losing ice at the rate of an area the size of California every week. By late September, we were 25% below the old record. And the headline on the front page of the Times said, "Scientists shaken by rapid melt of Arctic ice," as indeed they were, and indeed as they have been shaken by a whole variety of measurements that have come in either at the very top end of the charts or off them altogether in the last couple of years. The understanding, the emerging understanding, as more and more data is collected, both from real-world reactions like that and from our continuing investigations of paleoclimate, of past climate, is that we're in very, very, very serious and somewhat literal hot water at this point. The melt of the Arctic sea ice is, of course, significant in its own right, you know, and it removes this nice white shield above the Arctic that reflects about 80% of the sun's rays back out to space and instead now absorbs about 80% of the sun's rays in that nice blue water. But it's probably even more significant as a marker for other things that seem to be going on as well. The huge ice sheets above Greenland and the West Antarctic are no longer considered stable on a kind of century time scale as we used to think, and now seem to be very much in play. The melt there is happening extremely quickly. The old computer models assumed that we would, that as temperature rose, you'd see a little melt in the top few feet of the snow on these mile-thick sheets of ice every year, and that that water would politely evaporate off into the atmosphere. That's not what's happened. That water instead is finding fissures and cracks in these systems and making its way down to the bottom. And when I say that, you might envision a trickle, but that would be incorrect. There are about 1,000 of these meltwater moulins, as they're called, over Greenland, according to the last observational data from this fall, some of them as large as Niagara Falls. Water pouring down to the base of these glaciers, where it serves to grease the skids for their slide into the ocean. So all of a sudden, in the last year or so, we've come to understand that we may not be talking about sea level rise this century measured in inches or in feet, which we'd been expecting, but measured in meters, and perhaps several of them. James Hansen, our foremost climatologist, testified in federal court last year in a case brought by Detroit to avoid having to increase automobile mileage. He testified that it was entirely plausible that by century's end, we could see 5 or 6 meter rise in sea level if we weren't able to bring carbon under control very quickly. 5 or 6 meter rise in sea level is civilization challenging on a scale that we've never even begun to imagine or think about before. It's hard to envision that kind of world, just as it's hard to envision many other features of it. Suffice it to say that the stakes are ever so much higher, and that the number associated with this period of fear, the number is 350, okay? And that's the number I really want you to keep in your mind for a little while. 350 parts per million. Hansen and others at a presentation at the American Geophysical Union meeting in San Francisco in December published a paper saying that 350 represented the upper limit of any possible safe zone, 350 parts per million CO2. That's as high as we could safely go, which is very bad news because at the moment, the atmospheric concentration of CO2 is 385 parts per million, okay? We're not talking about a future problem. We're out of the safe zone. We're way out of the safe zone and going higher all the time. It's a new way of understanding this problem and thinking about it. But if you think about it even for a minute, it makes complete sense. I mean, if we're at 385 parts per million and the whole Arctic is melting, then clearly the place we want to be is well below that. And Hansen's calculations and others say 350. Now, it's not like going to the doctor and, you know, being told that your cholesterol is too high, okay? It doesn't mean that you immediately keel over and die any more than it means we immediately have ecological catastrophe. It means we're at greatly elevated risk as long as we remain up there. But like cholesterol, you know, if we take the stress off the system, if we stop adding carbon to it, I mean, you know, when you get bad cholesterol, the doctor says no more cheese. You know, in this case, the doctor more or less says no more coal. If we can stop pouring carbon into the atmosphere, there is a carbon cycling system on this planet that will take some of that carbon out and eventually get us back down to something that approximates a safe level. But we've got to do it pretty quickly before we pass somewhat unknown but irrevocable tipping points. Any moment we stay out of that safe zone, we're in great danger. So that's point one. 350 is where we need to be now. And if we don't, I mean, this is the biggest thing that human beings have ever done. Nothing we have done that compares with this effect, okay? Second, to date, we've done very little politically about this, obviously. In this country, we've done essentially nothing. No law has been passed in Congress. We've done in the past few years some good things at state and local levels, but they haven't been enough to show up in the statistics about how much carbon we emit, which continues to go up year after year, the same around the world. There are reasons for that, and some of them are predictable and obvious. You know, huge opposition from a few vested interests who have an enormous amount to lose and whose power is strong in a system as open to that influence and power as ours. ExxonMobil made more money last year than any company in the history of money, okay? They made $40 billion in clear profit. In our system, that buys you a lot of power. And they've used, and others have used that power effectively to cast doubt, block action, whatever, for two decades. However, they're only able to really exercise that power because there's an enormous amount of inertia among the rest of us. We're all at some level or another implicated in this question, and it makes it harder for us to take action and makes many of us reluctant to do so. Politicians are extremely sensitive measuring instrument for figuring out how much people will tolerate what they want. That's what they're in the business of, and they're good at it. And the fact that they've been unwilling to provide real leadership on this question is the result of their understanding that people wish not to be led on this question. And probably, so far, they're more or less correct. And there's also, of course, the very real point that it's difficult for any of us to demand action on these questions from around the world, from the position of privilege that we occupy in a world where there are still billions of very poor people for whom the easiest path out of that poverty at the moment would be burning the very cheap coal that's extremely abundant in China and India and elsewhere. Okay, so that factor too has slowed any progress. At the moment, there are the first stirrings of some kind of real movement in this country, I think. And you began to see it with Hurricane Katrina. What it revealed about the momentum of the physics and chemistry was frightening. You began to see it with Al Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth, and the Live Earth concerts and things that followed. You begin to see it with all that action on the state and local level. But it hasn't been a coordinated political movement to achieve action at the center in Washington and then in some kind of international treaty, which is what we need. Because only the center, only Washington, only internationally can we materially affect the price of energy. And affecting the price of energy is the sine qua non for letting our economy go to work to do something about this problem. The reason that markets, which generally work fairly well to deal with things like this, have done nothing about carbon is because they get no information about carbon. There is no price signal. It's treated as a free good, and hence they have no way to go to work on it. They're completely impotent against this problem. All the proposals that people make on a national and international level basically get down to giving markets information about carbon, and enough information and strong enough information that they correct the problem quickly, not slowly, okay? That's what the fight is about. For that to happen, for there to be the kind of stiff laws that we would need, the stiff caps on carbon and reductions that we would need if we were going to have any hope of getting back to 350, we need some kind of coordinated political movement to force that change to happen. I'm going to talk for a minute about the work we've done in the last year or so to try to build that movement in this country, and then I'm going to go on to talk about the global work that we badly need your help with now. And let me say that I do this largely from the point of view of a somewhat clueless amateur. I'm a writer by trade, not a political organizer, an activist, and we've been learning on the job as we went along. 18 months ago or so, out of just despair that nothing had really happened on this issue, I organized with a couple of other friends a march across the state of Vermont, which is a kind of funky place, Vermont, and it worked pretty well. We walked for 5 days to our main, sleeping in fields at night and things, and by the time we got to Burlington, our main town, we had about 1,000 people walking, which in Vermont is a huge number of people. Enough to get all of our candidates for federal office to come meet with us. And it was revelatory when they did. Not only did they come meet with us for our final rally, but They all got up and signed under this pledge to support what at the time was a very radical piece of legislation, one that would cut carbon emissions 80% by 2050 in this country. At the time, pretty fringe and pretty radical idea, but they all signed up, including, you know, the conservative Republicans who were running for Congress and Senate. The woman who was running for Congress on the GOP ticket and who almost won had said 2 months before when she announced for office that she didn't know if global warming was real and that more research needed to be done, the kind of standard waffle of the political right. It turned out that the more research that needed to be done was not about physics or chemistry, it was about how many people would walk across the state of Vermont, okay? And the irrefutable finding of this experiment was that 1,000 was enough because she signed on and then used her signature all the way through the rest of her campaign, put it in all her commercials, everything. She photoshopped out all the names of all the other people who'd signed, but it was very cool. It was good for us because in an odd way, it made those of us who'd coordinated this thing a little less cynical about politics than we'd otherwise been. I think we'd maybe grown unhealthily cynical about politics. And it was good to see that we could exercise a certain amount of power. What was sad was to open the Burlington newspaper the next morning and read a story that said that 1,000 people may have represented the largest demonstration that had yet taken place in this country about climate change, okay? But the biggest thing that human beings have ever done. We decided to see if we could do this on outside of strange, funky old Vermont. On January 10th of last year, we opened a website. John opened the website, stepitup07.org. Okay? We didn't have any money. We didn't have any mailing lists or anything like that. We just started sending out emails to people we knew and asking them to send them on and asking everyone to organize demonstrations in their communities on April 14th, so about 3 months hence. We had no reason to expect very much. Our kind of secret goal was that we might organize 100 of these rallies by that date, which would have been 100 more than there had been. Instead, the thing just took off. And 3 months later, there were 1,400 of these rallies on the same day in April in all 50 states. It was the biggest day of environmental grassroots environmental action since Earth Day in 1970. It was really striking. And what was so striking about it was how self-organized and sort of open source the entire enterprise was. We didn't have a march on Washington, as people urged us to do, partly because we thought it was crazy to tell people to drive across America spewing carbon in order to protest global warming, and partly because we thought people would do a better job in their own place making this thing real to other people. And so they did. The level of creativity on display was completely inspiring. People came up with all kinds of great ideas. Key West, Florida. Only coral reefs in the continental US. Coral reefs, not an ecosystem that's gonna fare very well with global warming, already under incredible siege, maybe gone entirely, these ecosystems, by mid-century. They did an underwater demonstration. All these people in scuba gear down with big signs and big like fish swimming around in the middle of it. It was very cool. A little further up the coast in Jacksonville, Florida. I've never been to Jacksonville, but my strong sense is that it's different from Vermont. And in Jacksonville, their like sacred space that they got was the parking lot of the Jacksonville Jaguars football stadium, okay? Because in the fall, it's where community is. They have these huge tailgates and stuff. This was in the spring, so they took it over. They got a crane, and they winched a yacht 20 foot up into the air. And they said, look, when Greenland slides into the ocean, that's where the ocean will be. And you could just hear, you know, people in Jacksonville just say, okay, now I get it. We had thousands of people in Lower Manhattan in blue shirts, all holding arms and forming, we called it a sea of people, to show where the tide line would fall across the most expensive real estate in the earth and that kind of thing. We were able that day to upload images of all 1,400 of these demonstrations and get them up on the web by nightfall so we could show them to people in Washington. It got insanely good coverage all around the country, both in local press where it was dominant on the Sunday papers, but also on all the network evening news shows and, you know, all the places you'd want. It did its job, and it did its job surprisingly well politically. This fringe idea, radical fringe idea a few months before, by the time we were done, within a week of that demonstration, both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama adopted that 80% by 2050 stance as the centerpiece of their own energy platforms going forward into the campaign. Indeed, all the Democratic presidential candidates did. The bill working its way through Congress afterwards, currently in the Senate, isn't quite as good as we'd hoped. It calls for 70% reductions by 2050, but a year ago it would have called for, 20% reductions or something like that. With lots of other people, we were able to really amp up the voltage on this question. And we were able to do it because there were people all over the country who were eager to do something more than what they've been able to do. The screwing in the new light bulb. We kept hearing from people who said, I screwed in the new light bulb, and even as I did it, I thought, this is not going to solve global warming. What can I really do? And our unofficial mantra became, screw in the new light bulb, and then screw in the new senator, and the second more important than the first. And so we felt reasonably good about the sort of proof of concept, about the ability to use the web in really interesting ways, use it to allow real life interaction and politics and demonstration and things, and then to take that real life stuff and bring it back onto the web and knit it together in a way that made it much more than the sum of its parts. It was, for us, extraordinarily interesting, and it has continued to cause us to think and to plan. So what we're launching at the moment, and this website in its preliminary version went up 2 days ago, is a new effort. This one aimed at sparking the same kind of grassroots global activism all around the world, okay? A ridiculously ambitious task and one without any real precedent. The idea, and it's at 350.org, this very preliminary, just kind of placeholder website. John is embarrassed to even have, me let people go look at it, but it's there to sort of collect names and ideas for the next few weeks. The idea is that all we want to do, our only goal with this, but we think it's a very important goal, is to take that number, 350, and tattoo it into people's brains to make it the most unescapable meme on the planet. On the theory that since we can't the huge international negotiations that are going on to reach a climate treaty sometime in the next 3 or 4 years aren't easy to kind of influence by normal means. There's no kind of Congress to go vote out of office or whatever. There's just this huge kind of amorphous international effort. That the only way we'll be able to influence it is to have public opinion focused on a tough target that almost automatically, just like sort of introducing that 80 by 2050 number, will begin to move people and thinking in that direction. We need to make people understand that that number represents some possibility of safety for the human enterprise, and indeed in certain ways for the whole kind of late Pleistocene suite of species and flora and fauna and everything else, that it's the most important number that there is. Now, to make that happen, and this is point three, and here I will end because what I really want to do is hear what you all have to say. To make that happen, we need immensely more creativity than we have as a small group. It only will work if this becomes a kind of real experiment in how to do this kind of thing in a real open source fashion. Look, in many ways, the world is completely screwed right now. I mean, in ways that are, as I sort of tried to outline, are very deep and difficult to deal with. The one wild card that we possibly have, I think, is this relatively new technology, still very new in much of the developing world, of the web, that allows at least the possibility for the spread of this, something as simple as this number, into every corner of the planet. If not over the computer, then over the mobile phone via texting. And those of you who've been out in the farthest corners of the developing world know that in places where there is no reliable electricity, where there are people with no reliable drinking water or sanitation or anything else, the one thing that there's likely to be in the humblest of all villages is at least one person with a mobile phone. And they're the kind of connection to the rest of the world. What we need And what we need your ideas about are hundreds and thousands of ways to take that number, 350, and make it real in the real world, you know? And they've got to be diverse in every kind of way. What kind of music? What kind of art? What kind of video project? What kind of political demonstrations? What kind of, I was talking to someone last night and she said, well, you know, I coordinate the biggest bluegrass festival in the country, and I'm gonna put 350 banjo players up on stage simultaneously in July to, you know, say, okay, that's good, that'll help. Any set of ideas like, you know, any way to, ecologically safely spray paint huge graffiti across melting glaciers, how to do any of the kind of things that will constantly draw attention to this number over time. It's like it's the whole thing is a kind of thought experiment. What if, and in this case, I truly think it does, the safety of the planet depended on spreading a very arcane number to every corner of the globe. How would you make that happen? What would you do? I don't know the answer to that. You all are going to be closer to knowing the answer to that. You've spent a lot of time thinking about how things spread virally, what it means to get a meme out into the bloodstream of the planet. This is one of the things that we have to offer, you know, the rest of the Earth. We have, in many ways, wrecked much of the rest of the planet with the ways in which we've lived. You know, Americans produce 25% of the world's CO2. And we've done our best to encourage nations around the world to follow our particular wasteful example. And now the Chinese and Indians and others are, in many cases, taking us up on that dare. But we also have invented this particular and fascinating technology that allows, almost by accident, since it wasn't really the intent, for the spread of this kind of meme throughout the circulatory system of the world, and maybe just in time. So there I'm going to end to say, please go on that website and give us your information so we can be in contact, but even more, click where it says send us some ideas and think about all the ways for this to happen. It has to happen quickly, and it has to happen incredibly efficiently. We don't need, I mean, the level of detail that if we're going to solve this problem, I guess is what I'm saying, is it's going to come from that most basic set of decisions about how tough targets we can enact as a world in the next few years. And from that, much else will flow. The particular sets of technologies that we'll use to replace our current energy systems, you know, how we'll use biofuels or nuclear fuels or energy efficiency or, you know, on and on and on. The basic point is to finally get this stone dislodged and rolling somehow, this massive boulder of inertia that's prevented us from doing anything so far. Our hope is that that a kind of guerrilla, effective, artful use of the web may be the key to unlocking this thing, to getting that boulder rolling. And that's why I really wanted to be here, and I'm incredibly grateful to y'all for helping out. So thank you.
So in enough, you advise a great deal of caution over the use of genetic engineering, more with human beings than with other things.
Yeah.
So how do you feel about announcements like Craig Venter's recently that he believes in 18 months he'll deliver a bacteria which metabolizes carbon dioxide and gives out methane, which is natural gas, in sunlight, which, if he's correct about his prediction, would be tremendously good for the carbon problem?
It might be very helpful. There's a whole suite, in fact, of these sort of geoengineering solutions of one kind or another, ranging from the sort of microscopic like that to the incredibly vast, you know, putting floating mirrors in space to deflect sunlight and on and on and on. They all share the common problem of being extremely hard to control once you get them going and being often kind of blunt and crude instruments. And most of the research so far on these things leads one to a kind of real caution about employing them. On the other hand, we've now been carrying out an uncontrolled experiment on the atmosphere of this planet for a couple hundred years. And in the last 50 years, it's gotten incredibly intense. We've taken the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere from 275 parts per million to 385. And so in a certain sense, all bets are off. You know, I think everybody's more willing to reconsider some of those schemes than they have been in the past. And we may at some point have to come to that. For the moment, and really for the foreseeable future, by far the wisest thing we can do is stop adding to the problem, cutting emissions and cutting them significantly. We're perfectly capable of doing it. We know to a rough order what the sort of level of technologies we would use to replace the ones we've got now, and that's what we should be doing first and foremost, is what I would say.
I'd like to ask, first, this is great, and I'm going to help you.
Thank you.
And everyone else should, too. But I'd also like to ask two sort of related questions, if I could. First, if you talked about some of the problems of sitting in rooms like these and then talking to less developed countries and saying, well, you've got to stop your expansion, right?
Yep.
And I'm wondering, so the first part of my question is about how 350 takes that into account.
Yep.
Because I think there's some fear in that world that 350 might mean we get to keep doing what we're doing and you guys all have to stop and we'll get to 350. And then the second related question is more about how you see this new movement, and particularly using the web, connecting to international climate justice movements, and particularly ones that hold the idea that leadership in climate change movements should come from the most affected communities.
These are absolutely right. And leadership should come from those communities, but leadership should also come from the community that's done the most damage. You know, we, in a sense, have the obligation to take the step forward and say, look, this is, in certain senses, on us. One of the most important reasons we've got to do this around the world is to build some real political pressure on the U.S. The rest of the world needs to realize and needs to say insistently that we're a problem. They're beginning to. Evo Morales, the president of Bolivia, said in a speech a couple of weeks ago that, you know, he thought that there was something ironic about Al Gore getting the Nobel Prize, you know, that it was good he'd written this book and things, but that he was a representative of the society that had caused the most damage here. I think that these questions of equity are going to be the most difficult ones to answer and deal with. And the reason that if we don't get this done, it won't get done, you know. There's no way to say to the Chinese, you've got to stop burning coal because we filled up the atmosphere, okay? They're not going to do it, and there's no moral reason for them to do it. The residence time of carbon in the atmosphere is 100 years. We've been burning it for more than 100 years. It'll take, even without the disparity in population, it'll take 40 years before China's as responsible for global warming as we are, and there are four times more of them. The only way is some kind of this grand global bargain that people have talked about that takes some small part of the wealth we built up in 100 years of doing this and transfers it largely in the form of technology north to south to allow people to develop decent lives without burning that carbon. Whether that's still possible or whether we've sort of passed the point is, I think, the strong open question. It's very clear that, you know, the next U.S. president will be the last one who gets to have a play a significant role in deciding this, you know, one way or another. That we're not talking about something happening 20 or 30 years down the future. We're talking about some kind of bargain struck in the next few years. And it's why we think it's so important to get this going globally and why we're so eager to raise enough money that we can hire staff in every corner of the planet to spread this message effectively.
Hi. I also think this is a fantastic initiative, and I'll be working every day to help support it.
Fantastic.
But my question is this. We've seen some of the opponents of political action on the climate issue shift their strategy recently, perhaps best exemplified in the recent Tierney article, to saying, well, we shouldn't spend all these resources trying to stop emitting carbon. Instead, we should commit them to keeping economies strong and adapting to the effects of climate change. Now, I am in no way sympathetic to this argument, but we need some ammunition against people who want to say, let's give up and stay rich as possible.
And they would argue that that, I mean, the sort of classic guy who argues this is the Swede Bjorn Lomborg, who I had a memorable debate with in Middlebury that you can see online, in fact, someplace. If you Google it, you can watch our epic debate. And I wouldn't tell you to watch it unless I was pretty convinced I'd kicked his butt. So the argument is that as you say, that countries need to grow rich so that they can somehow ward off climate change. Well, it's a completely perverse argument. The only possible way for countries to be able to prosper is to slow down this thing enough that they have some chance of not just being overwhelmed by it. If you're a developing country now, okay, it's as if you're running on a treadmill trying somehow to develop, which is hard in and of itself. And climate change is like pushing the button that increases the slope and the speed of the treadmill every minute, you know, just makes it tougher and tougher. For instance, I told you about these dengue fever outbreaks across Latin America, okay? To treat one case of dengue fever in Latin America takes way more money than's allotted per capita for all medical care in any of those countries. It costs a few hundred dollars, which is more than they budget per person. So it means that you can't treat anything else. You can't treat tuberculosis. You can't treat malnutrition. You can't treat HIV/AIDS. Your whole system gets overwhelmed because you're just carrying in stretcher after stretcher with people who got a mosquito bite from Aedes aegypti, you know? And there's a particularly perverse problem because bed nets don't even work. This is a diurnal mosquito, you know, that's out there doing its damage. I mean, the people who will suffer, we're all going to suffer horrific consequences from climate change, but the people who will suffer them most overwhelmingly and very rapidly are precisely the people living closest to the margin. There's no way to get them rich in some, you know, fashion in the next 20 years to ward it off. There's not enough money in the world to build levees and dikes around lowland Asia, you know? And there's no place for the 140 million people in Bangladesh. They don't have some option about where they're going to go once they get flooded out. I mean, they live next to India. India's not filled with vacant farmland just kind of waiting for a tide of people to sweep over from Bengal. You know what I mean? So that argument, as you can tell, gets me worked up. And it's very right to raise it. And it's why we need some strong expression of international solidarity around this issue, to be able to say to people on their mobile phones, on their, you know, across their web, look, at some level, we understand how badly we've broken this system. We're deeply committed to repairing it and to figuring out how to do it as a world.
Hi, I'm Liam. I work for a company here in Austin called Enviromedia Social Marketing, and we've been around for about 11 years, and all we do is environmental and public health campaigns. I have a shameless plug, and then I have a question, and I guess I'll do the shameless plug first, which is we started a website in January called greenwashingindex.com. Mm-hmm. Sounds like you're familiar with it, and it's a great opportunity for consumers to kind of learn more about consumer brands that are promoting themselves as being green and really kind of finding out, are they truly green or are they greenwashing themselves by painting a different picture? And the coal industry is sort of was the inspiration for this. The poster child, because they're now big on this clean coal campaign, which there's really nothing clean about coal. We all know that. So the question I have for you, though, is there's a bit of an ethical dilemma. I run IT and new media at Enviromedia, and it's kind of ironic to hear, you know, you talk about this at an interactive conference when one of the greatest sources of, you know, coal consumption and pollution is computers and those of us that are interactive developers and designers, you know, we're just consuming more and more computers all the time. And probably a lot of us in this room have probably been guilty of throwing away a laptop battery as opposed to taking it to e-cycling. So, you know, we're part of the problem. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering if you have any insight into happening with technology.
I don't have any unbelievable insight except to say that, you know, I mean, look at me. I spend most of my time flying around the country. You know, I have a carbon footprint, so because, you know, this is what I do, is work on these questions. If you're going to be using, you know, a laptop or using a jet, you know, but preferably a laptop, the use of it is, you know, the best and highest use of those electrons is to be working on just this question, and to be using it. Because you're absolutely right. I read an amazing statistic the other day that because of the energy drain, that for sort of active players of, say, Second Life an avatar in Second Life is now likely to consume as much power as a person in sub-Saharan Africa in the course of a year, okay? That's pretty astonishing idea. So, you know, hunched over the laptop, the thing to be doing. We're in an emergency. So in an emergency, you use the tools that you have to hand. That's the best I can do.
Hi, my name's Terry. I'm with the City of Austin. And my question goes to your thoughts about your strategic position as in building a social movement. And you've described, what you've described so far is necessary, it's great, and more of that is better. And the observation about that is that it necessarily is focused on appealing to people's individuals' better nature to round up, you know, a globe's worth of these individual acts of virtue. Mm-hmm. And that's fine, that's necessary. I just wonder if it's sufficient because, you know, people will do individual acts of virtue up to a point of inconvenience. And then just this specific strategic point is there's been a lot of discussion in the peak oil community in the last several years, naming climate change and energy depletion as the carbon twins. And on the one hand, climate change says we shouldn't burn this fuel. Peak oil says, oh, by the way, we're not going to get to. There's kind of a stick and carrot strategically there. I'm just wondering if you've extended your thinking to bring in some of the peak oil community.
Yes, or absolutely. Some of that and these are people I work with a lot and admire. The one thing I want to say, just because you raising it makes it clear that, as usual, I've been less clear than I should be. It's not what we don't want to collect sort of acts of individual virtue. We want to collect communities involved in politics, you know, involved in taking this idea and announcing it to their neighbors and to the world, this number, okay, which is politics. And the only hope of making, remember I said that thing about don't screw in the new light bulb, screw in the new senator, okay, that's, you know, the only hope of doing this is politically and in short order, because only by doing it politically can you get to the center of the economic equation that would allow us to then transform all our individual lives. And the good thing about political action, always worth bearing in mind, is that it does not take 51% of people to get something done. 5% of people up and working hard on something is more than enough to win any of these battles. You know, the civil rights movement, 1% of Americans maybe ever engaged in a march or a protest or a rally or whatever else, but that moral witness was more than enough to bring the rest of the country to their side. You know, we did this huge, biggest since 1970 kind of day of grassroots climate action. Maybe we had a couple of 100,000 people out around the country, including a bunch here in Austin. If any of you were there, great. But that's how we can do that kind of politics in time. But I very much take your point. And my intellectual work these days, book writing and things, is largely about these questions of local economies and that kind of thing. And so I work a lot with people in the peak oil world and find it really useful.
Also, could you repeat the name of the website again, please?
Yes, it's very good question. 350.org. We tried our best to make it memorable. And it turns out that you have to pay a lot of money to get a really short website on the but that was where our main use of our resources has been so far.
Do you think that a tipping point in terms of catastrophe is connected to or even prerequisite for a tipping point in terms of our action?
It's a very good question. And probably to a certain extent, the answer is yes. You know, as I say, Hurricane Katrina, you know, clearly changed political perceptions, and this melt of Arctic ice clearly changed things, whatever. The problem is that you reach a certain point where catastrophe has an almost perverse effect, you know, where the response won't become a sort of more generous attempt to, it'll become circle the wagons, we're in deep trouble, let's save our own skins, screw Bangladesh, you know, whatever else. So I think it's a mixed blessing. And I guess I think we've just got to work with what we have. And unfortunately, the world is going to supply plenty of catastrophes along the way to help underline the point.
Hi, Bill.
Hi there.
My name is Catherine Generakis, and I ran the interactive strategy for Live Earth for the concerts that happened last summer. I wanted to let people know, which I think many don't, that we're not done. I think we take very seriously our responsibility here in the U.S. to sort of take some leadership. So we're planning some events for this fall before the election to sort of continue the momentum. I wanted everybody to know that the Alliance for Climate Protection, which is the nonprofit that Al Gore started in conjunction with the Live Earth events, is also rolling out a major campaign this spring. So there's some domestic stuff happening sort of on a hopeful note. I think I've seen more international collaboration among climate organizations that are working directly with individuals than has happened previously. The environmental movement has been a little territorial, I'd say, in the past, and I think we're starting to move beyond that, which is really exciting. Some of the things that happened around the Bali conference between climate organizations was very positive and collaborative. And the last thing, I think I just sort of want to challenge this conference. I'm so glad you're here and that they brought you here. I think that this community of leadership around interactive strategists and developers, like this group is as important as any in sort of taking sort of a thought leader position on this issue, and as much as this can push it. And I'm happy to try, and we're going to do a whole bunch of sort of user-generated campaign stuff over this summer and fall, and we can certainly fold the 350 stuff
absolutely
into that. I wouldn't also underestimate how difficult it's been to craft a message that is, as we tried to do, applicable worldwide. It's incredibly hard on this issue. It is a issue that plays out particularly differently in every country.
Yep.
And so,
and those of us in the kind of guerrilla end of things are always very glad that this sort of army represented by people like Al Gore and his troops are, you know, doing very good work. No question.
I think along those same lines, I wonder if you could, I like the 350 number because it's this planetary scale kind of thing. I wonder if you could sort of help me understand, how do you contextualize that on the scale of a country enacting specific legislation?
That's a very good question. And it's why, for the most part, 5 minutes, okay. And then we're supposed, I think I have to go off to the book corner or something, but I'm happy to continue carrying on conversations wherever that's, you probably know where that is, I don't really, but someone will show me. That's the problem, I mean, in a sense, that's the next order problem, okay? There's going to be an international agreement signed sometime in the next 3 or 4 years, a follow-on to the Kyoto Treaty, which expires in 2011 or 2012. And that treaty is going to set targets that all countries have to then meet, okay? And the question is going to be whether it sets tough enough targets or not. And at the moment, it won't come anywhere close to the kind of discussions going on in Bali and things where, if you know, well short of this kind of 450 target that we were talking about. One of the hardest part of that equation is going to be figuring out how you divide up the world's carbon allocations, who has to give the most, as it were. We're clearly going to have to give the most, right? Because we've burned all this stuff, and because we have the technological and financial wherewithal. I mean, we can become essentially a zero carbon society in the course of the next few decades. We have the technology to do it, and we can create the technology that we don't have now. Much harder for very poor countries for whom coal at a penny a kilowatt hour, you know, which is what it is in China more or less, is enormously attractive. And so the bargaining is going to be about how much we're willing to go, us in the rich world, to make up that gap, right? That's why we need an understanding in this country of the international stakes, so that there'll be some real pressure on us to step up when we get to those negotiations. And it's why other countries need some understanding of them, so they'll be pressuring us to step up, and so that they'll understand that the unfortunate part of the situation is that they have no choice but to figure out. I mean, the real horror of it is if you're India, you know, say, on the one hand, you want to burn coal so you can develop, and that's the cheapest, most obvious thing to do. And on the other hand, you know you're screwed first if the climate warms, you know. And That's the horrible and inescapable fact of the situation that we're in right now.
I just want to take it back to your first book, The Age of Missing Information, and whether or not you are applying anything you wrote about in that book towards the landscape we have now, where a lot of people talk about suffering from social network fatigue, where it's initiative after initiative, it's new tool after new tool, it's new network after new network, and whether or not you see this just being yet another thing people are approached with.
Hopefully not. One of the questions that people have been asking us in the last few months is, why did you shut down? Why did you stop doing Step It Up? Because it was really successful last year and had, you know, all these big demonstrations. And there's lots of people calling saying, are we going to do this again April 14th of this year? And we were saying, no, we're not going to. This was a one-off short campaign that, you know, we wanted to pour everybody's energy into this one thing. And the same now with this global thing. It's not going to go on forever. It's not designed to go on forever. It's designed to be a campaign, a kind of attack, and to have a very limited life, you know, at most sort of 18 months as we gear up and to take on as much as it can a life of its own. And here's the crucial part, to have most of its actual existence offline, you know, to use this tool to catalyze people to go do things in the real world in their community, to make art, to make music, to make political demonstration, to do all those things in the real world, and then to upload it back to the web so everybody else can see it, understand it, be inspired by it, go out and do it themselves. So that's the hope. That fatigue, I think, is a real problem, and always is for political organizers, and it's why, you know, it's so important for all you to come up with creative ideas for us to use. Ways to make this fresh, powerful, break through some of that clutter. Because, I mean, it's quite amazing, but there is a sense in which, you know, people, I feel myself sort of bored with the idea of global warming, you know? It's like, I've heard about that already. I mean, in fact, I've heard about it for 20 years. There's days when I'm incredibly sick of it and bored of it and eager to go on to some other, but what do you know, it's keeps happening, you know, and it's a particularly relentless problem because it doesn't yield to sort of the usual halfway compromises that we usually make around political issues. That's how politics usually works, okay? In this case, physics and chemistry don't bargain. They won't meet us halfway. We have to understand what the physical reality is and then do what we're going to do, which is why we need transformative change, not incremental, and why, in a certain sense, this is a kind of Hail Mary pass, you know, thrown, just sort of lobbed toward the end zone in the hope that it might connect in time.
Hi, Mr. McKibben. I'm a big admirer of yours, and thank you for speaking. I'm going to be real quick here. I will be bold and speak for this room and say no one here is interested in trashing the planet, and everybody is very busy. As such, I would love to see this as the most creative, dynamic group of people in America in this building right now. I would love to see you guys invent something that makes it painfully, stupidly easy for all of us to be both green consumers and green activists. One of you out there, instead of inventing the next Flickr tool, can invent Napster for green energy, can invent an easy way to power my car by wind or to build a windmill on the top of my house. One of you can do it. So let's focus these energies on something that can cause that kind of change instead of things that are merely amusing and fun, because we can do things that are both good and amusing and fun with the energy in this building. Thank you.
And it actually turns out to be fantastically amusing to try and subvert the system, you know? It's way more energy and way more fun to do that than to sort of try to do it over and over again on a game or whatever. It's incredibly exhilarating to look around and realize that you've actually begun to upset ExxonMobil or alarm the, you know, world at large because you've been, you know, organized something where you live and made it real and put it on the web for people to see. I sense that we need to end, yes? And there's incredibly primitive paper and pencil sign-up sheet around for anybody who hasn't logged on already and put their information in. Thank you so much, and I'll get down and talk. Actually, I'm sorry.
I just want to draw on the enthusiasm and energy of the last commenter and say, let's start an eco-internet tech community right out of this room. I was speaking to Bill's colleague, John, and he made a column on the sign-up sheet that said, star your name if you don't want it to be shared with the South by Southwest community. So, yeah, let's collaborate. You know, Bill, you said things should be open source and we should collaborate. So let's make some awesome tools happen.
We want help so bad. And thank you so much for
no
helping
tools.
Out.
See what you can do for yourself. You have to be the example. It begins at home.